This is an ABC podcast.
European Parliament in Strasbourg has just voted to approve major changes to European copyright law. The proposal had moved tens of thousands of Europeans to protest against the measures. They say they're worried about how new rules will affect free speech on the internet.
Copyright isn't the sort of thing that usually inflames people's passions and draws them onto the street. So what you might wonder is going on in Europe. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. A little later on Future Tense, we'll seek the counsel of two intellectual property experts who'll give us their take on the new EU Copyright Directive and what it means for digital expression and creativity. But first today, Professor Catherine Gelber, the head of the School of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Queensland. She's the co-editor of a book with UK-based philosopher Susan Bryson called Free Speech in the Digital Age. Catherine Gelber, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
David Kaye, the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, has talked about a global assault on freedom of expression. How serious do you think the situation is at the moment?
I think it's very serious, and I think we're facing a slightly unusual time in history. So I'm assuming that David Kaye meant the development of a whole new set of rules and laws around the world, particularly in the context of national security, which have had bipartisan support often in democratic countries and which have resulted in really significant restrictions on free speech generally and on freedom of the press in particular. So David Kaye was talking about the development of new laws and legislation. At the same time, I think we're seeing the idea of free speech used in public discourse to a degree that we haven't seen before. People like to talk about their free speech in a way that they didn't used to. So it's kind of contradictory. On the one hand, you have people more aware than they have been before, I think, that there is this thing called free speech and that they have a right to it. And on the other hand, really large scale in some instances, government regulations and laws developed that significantly restrict that right.
You've written that much of our discourse around free speech theory and practice is heavily influenced by US First Amendment jurisprudence, even in a country like Australia. So how did that come about and why?
That's a really interesting question. So the First Amendment is, constitutionally speaking, a unique provision in the world. There is no other democratic country that protects free speech to the extent to which the First Amendment does. Nevertheless, and perhaps because of that, I guess, the scholarship out of the United States, so the ideas and the literature around how we understand free speech, is incredibly influenced by the First Amendment. So in the theories and in the literature about free speech, people tend to take First Amendment informed views that support a stronger protection of free speech than is the case in pretty much any other country in the world. Certainly countries like the United Kingdom, for example, which has a Human Rights Act, allow and regularly legislate against harmful kinds of speech that are not able to be limited in the United States because of the First Amendment. So we have this unique constitutional provision, which is nevertheless very widely influential, and it's been influential insofar as it supports theories and ideas that tend towards the strongest possible protection of free speech. And that's really interesting because in the real world, all around the world, we actually have pretty routine regulation of speech.
Now, when you marry that with Silicon Valley libertarianism, do the two together with regard to free speech, do they explain the difficulty that we perhaps have in finding a suitable regulatory balance?
I think that it certainly contributes to it. So in the book that I've just published, one of the authors talks about techno-libertarianism, the idea that people take already existing libertarian views about free speech and then just apply it to the internet and apply it to the online sphere and say, well, you can't possibly regulate this space. This space has to be free of regulation, and that's the embodiment of what it means to have free speech and to have freedom. And I guess there are a whole lot of people who would respond to that by saying that doesn't reflect the real world in which we live. The real world in which we live is not a level playing field. The real world in which we live has certain groups and identities who are marginalised, who are prevented from speaking, or who don't have the same voice when they do speak. And those kinds of differentials in how we experience freedom of speech occur just as much in the online sphere as they do in the offline world.
Yet many people talk about a difference between speech that occurs online and speech within the physical world. And they use that almost as a justification for things like hate speech, don't they? Just explain how that works and what the thinking is there, the rationale is there.
Okay, so what the digital age has done is revive the idea, which is often implicit in these arguments, not explicit. It's revived the idea that when we speak, what we're doing is essentially externalising thought, and that therefore freedom of speech amounts to freedom of thought, and any regulation of speech is invalid because basically what you're doing is regulating people's thoughts in an Orwellian kind of situation where people don't have freedom of thought and don't have freedom of speech. So, for example, the 1996 Barlow Declaration said that cyberspace was a place of the mind. It was a place that is not where bodies live. And so the idea was promoted that in the online sphere, you're just engaging in exchanges of thought. That was in the early days of the internet. What we know now is that that's not the case, and that speech online, just as speech offline, speech actually does things in the world. And so I challenge the idea that speech online or offline is akin to thought, and I and many others subscribe to the view that speech, whether it's online or offline, is a type of conduct, and that conduct can do good things and that conduct can do bad things. So when people say, the internet age is just, we should all just be able to express ourselves freely. They're really saying speech should be thought of more as thought than as conduct, and I disagree with that.
And yet it is still influential in places like the United States, isn't it? It is still coming up as an argument in court cases, for instance.
That's right, it is. And in fact, I think it's becoming more influential as we grapple with the digital age and what it means for our speech. So, for example, there was an early case, really, in 1997 of a man who was challenged with intention to communicate to injure or harm in the United States because he had named a female classmate in an online site, a closed site online, and he had talked about raping and mutilating that person. And when he was charged with this criminal offence, he said, oh, but I didn't mean it. It was just me expressing my thoughts. There was another case, more recently, the Alonis case, of a man who threatened his wife online, and he was charged with a threat offence. And he also said, oh, no, it just happened online. It was just me externalising my thoughts. In fact, he claimed to be making comments that were closer to a rap singer than to reality. And he said, no, it clearly wasn't intentional because it happened online. So there have been court cases in which people have said that the fact that the communication happened online makes it less real. So, yes, we're very much in a situation where people are trying to argue, and the jury is still out on this one, but people are trying to argue that the fact that the speech took place online makes it qualitatively and substantively different from if they'd engaged in exactly the same conduct offline.
And you're listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell, and our guest is Professor Catherine Gelber, author and co-editor of Free Speech in the Digital Age. In trying to determine what we in society would see as acceptable speech and what is unacceptable speech, you've put forward what you call the capabilities-informed approach as an idea. Could I get you to take us through that approach and how you envisage it would work?
So I said before that in the literature on free speech that's been informed by the First Amendment, people see speech as akin to thought and that it's very difficult to regulate it, therefore. And so the theories of free speech that we have in our scholarship tend to support non-regulation of speech. So in my work, I find that unsatisfactory, that we can't have, or that we didn't have, a theory within the scholarship on free speech that said that there should be limits on free speech, that somehow previously people have brought in other arguments outside of the free speech scholarship to say, well, maybe we can balance it out, or maybe we can make an exception here or an exception there. So based on the work of Martha Nussbaum, who's developed what she calls the capabilities approach, I applied that to free speech and said, let's think about what speech does in the world, what speaking and being heard do in the world. Nussbaum's argument says that it's the responsibility of policymakers and governments to provide individuals with enough support, material support, educational support, and so on, for them to reach a threshold where they become capable of choosing how they want to live and how to live well. And so everything that is required for them to reach that threshold, it's the responsibility of governments to provide. So when you apply that thinking to free speech, you think, well, what does speech do in and for people's lives? life. Speech does a lot of things. Speech is absolutely intrinsic to enabling people to reach that threshold where they become capable of making life choices for themselves. But it's also true that some speech, hate speech for example, might hinder or harm other people's ability to reach that threshold. So by applying a capabilities approach, we have on the one hand a really robust reason to protect freedom of speech, right? Engaging in speech is absolutely crucial to reaching a point where you're capable of making meaningful choices about your life. At the same time, the very same theoretical approach gives us a good justification for regulating in particular ways, but for regulating speech that stops people being able to reach that threshold. And hate speech is one of those examples. So hate speech is a type of speech that can harm its targets to a sufficient degree to stop them from reaching that threshold. So I think when you bring a capabilities approach to it, you have this wonderful situation where you have both a robust reason to protect free speech and a robust reason to regulate the types of speech that are sufficiently harmful to stop people reaching that threshold.
Could I get you to give us a practical example of that? I mean, one of the issues in the news of late relates to the expression of religious belief and free speech. How would this capabilities-informed approach deal with, say, a religious statement and a dispute over whether that statement was actually harmful to others?
So that's a really great question. Obviously, we've had the Israel Folau case in the media a lot in the last few months in Australia.
This is the Australian footballer who's made controversial comments about gay people.
So my view is that it was made clear to Israel Folau by his employer, and certainly in the media discussion of it, that his religious freedom is not being infringed. He has the right to express his religious views in any way he wishes to do so. And in fact, in the past, he has put out a tweet, for example, saying something along the lines of, I don't support same-sex marriage. Because of my religion, I'm unable to support same-sex marriage. Now, that is completely within his right to do so. And regardless of how people might individually feel, if they might feel offended or whatever by that comment, he's perfectly entitled to do it. But the tweet that got him into the most trouble, because it was the last in a long line of tweets, was a tweet in which he said that gay people needed to repent, and if they don't repent, they will go to hell. And what he meant by that was gay people have no place on this earth, that the only way they can be on this earth legitimately is to not be gay, because that's what he meant by repenting. So in my view, that crosses the line. We've got research that tells us that when young gay people hear statements like that, that their rates of self-harm go up and that their rates of suicide go up. We know from the social research that these kinds of things, that saying to gay people they have no place on this earth, is harmful to them. It's harmful to their self-esteem. It's harmful to their well-being. It's harmful to their future. It's harmful in so many ways. So in my view, that's the difference. So any person of religious conviction who opposes, for example, same-sex marriage, or not even marriage, who opposes homosexual relationships, is entitled to say, in a way that doesn't harm people, due to my religious beliefs, I can't support same-sex relationships. But that is entirely different from saying, based on my religious beliefs, I'm going to tell you, you have no place on this earth.
But in a lot of issues like that, who determines what is harmful to the capabilities of others? Doesn't that leave it open to subjectivity?
Well, I think that the answer to that lies in connecting the capacity of somebody to harm with the vulnerability of the targets to harm. So in my view, in order to be vulnerable to that substantive harm that I just talked about, you need to be structurally disadvantaged, marginalised, and marginalised in the society in which that utterance takes place. So we know that gay people are structurally disadvantaged and marginalised in Australian society. So we can say that a comment like that amounts to harm against them. By contrast, we know that people with red hair, for example, or people with blue eyes, for example, aren't structurally, systemically discriminated against. So you could make a comment that, in your view, people with blue eyes, for example, should be denied the right to marry or should be not allowed to work in certain places. And that doesn't have the capacity to harm in the same way that a homophobic comment does in our society. So the key and the way that you determine who is capable of harming and who is vulnerable to harm, the answer to that question is the groups that are systemically disadvantaged and marginalised in the context in which that speech takes place.
Historically, free speech was usually talked about in the context of the relationship between government and citizens. But we now see that many private technology companies in particular are arbiters of what speech is allowed on their social platforms. And increasingly, algorithms and machine learning systems are being used to rate and to rank and to highlight particular data online. So what sorts of free speech principles should underpin the operations of those private companies, do you think? And what principles do underpin them?
So at the moment, it's not clear what principles do underpin them. It is clear that a number of social media companies, including Facebook, have come to the conclusion that the scale of the problem they're facing is so great that they need assistance. And so they're starting to ask for regulation. They're starting to ask for government support to help them do this regulation because they realise that they don't do it necessarily very well and that there are a lot of resources needed to be able to do that well. So the answer to how do they do it now is not particularly well. How should they do it? I think it would be good if social media companies were to revert to the core of the argument that I've been trying to make, which is that words do things in the world. Understand that words are not just streams of letters on a page or on a screen, but words do things in the world, and words can do good things and words can do bad things. So let's look at when the words do bad things. Are they of sufficient scale to warrant regulation? And only some of them are. Not all the bad things warrant a regulatory response. So if they're of sufficient scale to warrant regulation, like hate speech, let's regulate it. Let's take some things down. But if they're not of sufficient scale to warrant a regulatory response, then we need better leadership. Then we need people to understand that in the online world, just as in the offline world, the free speech right carries with it the responsibility not to do harm. And we need to talk about that more. And we need people to understand more that even though they might feel anonymous behind their keyboard, the things they're putting out onto those screens have repercussions in the real world. And if we can start moving the conversation in that direction, I think we'll make great strides forward.
Professor Catherine Gelber, co-editor of Free Speech in the Digital Age, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And the book is published by Oxford University Press.
The European Union has a plan to fix the way that copyright works on the internet. You've probably heard of it. It's called Article 13 and it's a bound to become law throughout the European Union. But there's a problem. Article 13 is really controversial, and some people think it could completely change the way we share content online and make it really difficult for small sites to compete.
The EU's new copyright directive has lots of detractors as well as supporters. It's been adopted by the European Parliament, and member states now have 2 years to transpose it into their own national laws. Associate Professor Eleonora Rosati from the University of Southampton.
The directive tries to achieve different goals, and in fact it contains provisions that look into different areas. So on the one hand, it is a directive that aims to make Europe more competitive on a technological basis by allowing text and data mining activities, which are necessary for the development, for instance, of artificial intelligence. And there are also provisions that are meant to remedy what is perceived as an unfairness, an imbalance in the allocation of value over the internet. And in particular, there is a provision which has been discussed at length and has proved quite controversial, which will make platforms like YouTube directly responsible for the content uploaded by users. And this new responsibility means that YouTube needs to obtain permission from relevant copyright owners in order to allow users to post videos on its platform. So in a sense, the aim of this directive is to make YouTube more responsible for the content hosted on its platform and also to pay higher fees when it comes to licensing agreements with the copyright owners.
But this doesn't just apply to YouTube, does it?
No. Of course, it is a provision that goes well beyond that. It applies to any platforms that host and makes available content uploaded by users and organizes it for profit. So any platform of this kind will fall within the scope of this provision. There are certain exclusions that are spelled out in the law. And so, for instance, Wikipedia will not be attracted within the scope of the provision, nor will the e-commerce platforms like eBay or Amazon or cloud storage services like Google Drive, for instance.
Platforms like YouTube have responded by saying that this is unworkable, that there is simply too much material posted on a daily and hourly, a minute by minute basis to actually make this work.
Yes, you know, what YouTube is highlighting is the fact that, of course, if on the one end it will need to secure permission to host that content, on the other end it will need to police what users post, so to prevent the uploading of unlicensed material, so to say. So in a sense, a lot of the discussion has revolved around what the filtering system for all this might be and whether filters might prevent unduly the posting of content that is perfectly lawful, such as parodies, criticism, reviews of other people's content, etc., etc. I would like just to stress that filtering systems as such are not something that has never been applied before, because YouTube itself has a filtering system in place. It has developed it over the past few years, and it is a content ID. For YouTube, complying with this new legislation will not be too far removed from what technically it does already. But of course, for smaller players, this would mean facing cost that might be quite substantial. Just to give you an idea, YouTube says that to develop its own filtering system, Content ID, it spent over $60 million, US dollars. The fear is that smaller platforms will not be in a position to afford paying this cost.
But the smaller platforms have now been exempt from this.
Exactly. So, for instance, if you provide a service in the European Union and you've done that for less than 3 years, you have a turnover of less than 10 million euros and you have less than 5 million unique visitors per month, then you will not be under an obligation to get a license, but you will need to be in a position where your responsibility and a possible liability is subject to a software regime. We will need to see how many platforms fall under these criteria and will be actually eligible for this software regime.
Associate Professor Eleonora Rosati. Australian intellectual property expert Professor Matthew Rimmer describes the Copyright Directive as a grab bag, and he says despite its approval by the European Parliament, there's still a lot of debate to be had.
The text of the directive is not particularly clear, and there's still a lot of debate over particular articles dealing with the so-called link tax and the upload filters. And there will no doubt be a lot of debate about the interpretation of the directive. 7 countries objected to the directive. So I guess those countries in particular will be thinking about ways and means of shaping the implementation of the directive in such a way as to guard against some of the perceived dangers of the regime.
And some of them, are they likely to appeal the directive?
So Poland has said that it wants to launch a challenge against the directive, saying that it's in breach of the Polish constitution and is otherwise in conflict with human rights principles in relation to freedom of expression. The actual nature of that challenge has not become apparent yet, so there's still a little bit of mystery as to the grounds that they might make their challenge to the directive. But in terms of public policy, they have said that, you know, Poland objected to the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, ACTA, back in 2011. They have very similar concerns to the European Copyright Directive. They think it will interfere with innovation and freedom of expression, and think that they have good grounds on which to stop the regime coming into force. And I guess perhaps that's also a reflection of some of the dissatisfaction with the process in terms of the negotiations in relation to the directive.
So we're not really going to know how effective this directive is, or indeed what it means for tech companies or for users of the internet, until all of those kind of issues are sorted out, until the appeals are put in, if they are put in, or until governments actually start to incorporate this into their legislation.
Well, once the laws are in place, you also have to kind of think about how those laws are put into practice, particularly in terms of the so-called upload filter. I mean, there's a lot of debate about how that would be workable or practical.
Or whether it's actually practical.
And, you know, whether or not it will be effective, or whether or not it will be overbroad and stop citizens uploading all sorts of material. And I guess that's also very kind of dependent upon technology. So there's been also quite a bit of debate about whether certain filter technology companies have been particularly pushing for the directive because they see a benefit from such a directive being put into place. So we'll have to see how the law operates in practice, and, you know, whether the supposed benefits are realised or some of the feared ills are manifest will depend a lot upon the implementation of the regime and what happens in litigation in respect of the regime. You know, the debate over the European Copyright Directive is not merely a kind of an abstract topic. I mean, it should also be noted that it is an issue on the horizon for Australia. So Australia, over the last few years, have passed site blocking laws, much like the European Union. And then in the past year, they've also passed expanded search filtering laws. And as part of the discussion process, the Department of Communications noted that they were keeping a watching eye on what was happening in the European Union in respect of the Copyright Directive, and they would certainly take that into account in terms of future considerations. So it's hard to know what the new Morrison government will do in relation to copyright law reform after the Abbott government and the Turnbull government. But it will be interesting to see whether local copyright industries push for similar sorts of mechanisms in Australia in relation to an upload filter and in relation to a link tax. And that will be very interesting to see whether or not we follow the example of the European Union, especially because we did follow their example in relation to site blocking laws.
So messy, but obviously it's an important one to watch.
Well, I mean, I think the European Union is very influential in a number of different ways in terms of setting norms around copyright law. And that has affected Australia in the past. So the European Union led with the copyright term extension back in the 1990s. And Australia, as a result of a free trade agreement with the US, went to from life plus 50 years to life plus 70 years in 2004. We're currently negotiating a trade agreement with the European Union. The European Union, no doubt, is quite interested in Australia adopting more features of the European Union intellectual property system, not only in respect of geographical indications for wine and food and things like Prosecco, but, you know, obviously the European Union has a very strong interest in the protection of their cultural industries. So no doubt they will be kind of raising some copyright issues as well in terms of the trade agreement currently under consideration between Australia and the European Union. So directly and indirectly, I think there are a number of different ways in which the European model in relation to the Copyright Directive could be something that could be taken up in Australia. Although Australia doesn't necessarily have the same human rights protections as the European Union, so there would be complications and complexities in terms of the implementation of some of those measures under discussion, because we don't necessarily have the same countervailing protections that are available in the system of the European Union.
Well, Matthew Rimmer, thank you very much.
Thank you kindly.
My co-producer for this edition of Future Tense was Edwina Stott. Send me an email or a tweet if you have a comment or indeed a story suggestion. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.